Alan Rusbridger has been the chief editor of the respected UK paper The Guardian since 1995, and last December, as he considered his retirement at the end of 2015, he had a chance encounter with Bill McKibben. Bill McKibben, as you may have heard in our broadcast last week, is a writer who has also become a leading activist confronting society about climate change and the fossil fuel industry. In the 20 years that Alan Rusbridger has led The Guardian, the paper has established an impressive reputation for environmental coverage. But that meeting inspired Alan to dedicate his remaining time as top editor to covering and campaigning for the climate. So, along with reporting on climate change, The Guardian is sponsoring a petition that calls on two of the world's richest foundations, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust, to divest their holdings in fossil fuels. And that petition already has over 100,000 signatures. Alan joins us now on the line from London. Welcome to Living on Earth.
I'm pleased to be here.
So, to start with, I understand that Bill McKibben is the one that maybe sparked the idea to devote your final year as editor to covering climate change. How did that happen?
Well, we both won an award in Sweden at the end of last year, and over lunch I was talking to him about his passion, which is the environment, and I said that I felt we'd never really sort of quite cut through. We've got five environment correspondents, so it's not like we hadn't done justice to the subject. But I thought we were victim to the fact that people switch off. I think when they read about the environment, it seems too dismal, too complicated. There's nothing they can do about it. And Bill told me about his campaign and the fact that the divestment movement in his mind was snowballing, was having the kind of cut through that traditional journalism wasn't happening. And that gave me the idea of combining the reporting with the campaigning to try and jolt people out of the complacency that I think they feel.
Why do you think the journalists have struggled to tell the climate change story?
Well, I've been thinking about that, and I think journalism, I think of it as a rear-view mirror, that journalism works well with things that have happened that you can describe. It works less well with things that might happen or things that move very slowly. So it's very difficult to describe the gentle melting of an iceberg or the change in the atmosphere. It's very difficult to definitely ascribe climate events, hurricanes and tornadoes and rains to climate change. So journalism just struggles to describe what's going on. And because nothing very dramatic happens from day to day, it slips off the front pages. I think readers have stopped reading about it because it feels, in a way, too frightening. I think, you know, psychologists have written entire books about this. And so somehow this story, which I think of as probably the most important story on Earth, is not being told by journalists.
I have to tell you that on a personal level, more than 20 years ago, I came to the conclusion that human-induced climate change is the most important story of the day. Started this program, Living on Earth, on public radio in the States, and have been telling the story. And I have to say, it's very hard to keep the enthusiasm going on this story. How do you plan to tell this story differently to engage people?
Well, I've been editing for about 20 years, and I've been quite reluctant to do big campaigns because I think campaigns only really work, to my mind, where you've got something about which there's no reasonable doubt. And there are not many stories which fall into that category. And I think where there is reasonable doubt, it's better to do reporting because then you can report all sides of the argument. With climate change, I think most people, most reasonable people, accept that the science is pretty settled. There's something like a 9-to-1 majority for scientists who think the same about the nature of the risk and its causes. And so I think where you've got that, I don't think there's any great obligation to bend over backwards to be balanced. And having decided that, then I thought, let's turn this into a campaign that involves reporting rather than simply reporting, which, you know, for one reason or another, isn't cutting through in the way that it has to. This is an urgent story. We can't afford to spend the next few years waiting for people to wake up to its seriousness.
Now, what was the reaction of your colleagues there at The Guardian when you told them about your idea that you were going to spend these last few months of your leadership of the paper in this campaign on the climate?
I can't remember ever having such universal enthusiasm. What I did over Christmas was to email a large number of people, not actually just in editorial, but across the organization, to say, look, we were thinking of doing this and who wanted to be involved. And about 45 people turned up to the first meeting. And I think what you realize is that it's not that people aren't interested, it's just that they can't find the vehicle to engage. And so once you say, look, we're going to do this and we want to harness the abilities of as many people as possible, there's tremendous enthusiasm because, you know, we're all people as well as reporters and workers here. We've all got young relatives or children or grandchildren. People are, on some level, deeply engaged in this existential threat that could put all that in jeopardy. So actually, there's been a fantastic internal and external response to what we're doing.
Now, as I understand it, The Guardian is launching what you're calling the Keep It in the Ground campaign. Tell me about it.
Well, I think there's one very simple way of looking at this, and this is Bill McKibben's way of framing it, which is if you concentrate just on three facts. One is that we have to stay within 2 degrees of warming. And I think there's universal consensus about that, even amongst people who disagree about how to do that. Civilization as we know it will begin to become very difficult to maintain above 2 degrees. The second fact is the amount of fossil fuels that people own and is in the ground. And the third fact is the amount of fossil fuels that can safely be burnt to stay within 2 degrees. The amount of known reserves of fossil fuels is vastly greater, about 4 or 5 times greater, than the amount that can be safely burnt. And so therefore, it is not safe to dig up all the oil and the gas and the coal that we know about. And once you agree on that, then you look at the companies and you say, well, these companies cannot be valued right. They're putting all this stuff in their books. In fact, they're searching for more, and yet they're never going to be allowed to use it for the sake of the species. And therefore, it has to be kept in the ground.
Well, there's one rather pressing factor, though. If you think of the end of slavery, perhaps as an analogy to the campaign that you're about, the value of a slave, for example, here in the United States, back in the day was equivalent to, say, a luxury car. If you tell these companies that they have to keep it in the ground, they have billions upon billions of dollars predicated on that. They're not going to go willingly, are they?
No, they're not. And therefore, you look at the levers that are going to change that. And there are two levers, either some form of governmental regulation or rationing or pricing. And the second is the financial levers of people realizing that this is, in a very real sense, a carbon bubble. These are assets that are going to be stranded. And that if you're a wise financial manager, you want to get out of that before that bubble bursts. There's not much a newspaper can do about the first bit. You know, of course, we can lobby governments to bring in the regulations and the limits. We looked to Paris for that to happen in December, but we thought that's not going to be a very engaging thing for readers. That feels like political wonkery. But the idea of trying to go for divestment, of trying to persuade people of the risk to their investments, and for them, either on moral grounds or probably more likely on pure financial self-interest grounds, to get their money out of fossil fuels before that bubble bursts. And again, we're not naive enough to think that if we rang up Shell or BP or Exxon and suggested that they kept the stuff in the ground, that that was going to have much effect. But I think there are organizations like the Gates Foundation, like the Wellcome Trust in Britain, which are devoted to science and medicine, who are progressive in every way in terms of the good that they do to humanity, and just say, look, don't you think that you ought to be taking the lead in terms of not having money in these things, which we know cause tremendous damage to the planet and to health?
And it's kind of interesting that when you realized that your own portfolio at The Guardian had plenty of fossil fuel holdings, so what did you decide to do about that?
We were aware that the moment we started writing this, people would point the finger back at us. The Guardian is a company that is run by a trust, it's a not-for-profit company is the simplest way of thinking about it. And we have about $8 billion invested, and we realized people would say, well, it's all very well to wag your fingers at others, but what are you going to do yourselves? And I went to the GMG board, the Guardian Media Group board, and said, look, this is an issue. You don't have to be bound by the Guardian's reporting and campaigning, but on the other hand, people are going to draw attention to what you do. And actually, the board went away and thought about it. And board is very hard-nosed business people, so they weren't making a woolly-minded choice, but I think they hadn't concentrated on the issue before. And the moment they did, they realized the sense in divesting, and they came out last week and said they would be divesting over a period of 2 to 5 years from all fossil fuels. So that was a tremendously encouraging start. I think that's the biggest fund so far that has divested.
How will you measure the success of this campaign? You've decided that it's appropriate now to begin advocating a particular position rather than just reporting on the news. It makes you a campaigning as well as a news organization. How will you measure the success of this decision and this campaign?
Well, to some extent, I think we've succeeded in galvanizing an awful lot of people to sign. I think that when I last looked, the petition had been signed by about 170,000 people. The people who are running the Paris talks have been in touch, and they say this is a fantastically helpful thing in terms of getting this on the radar of politicians and the people who are going to be negotiating at those talks. I think the fact that the Guardian Media Group has divested will make fund managers sit up and realize that there is an issue here they need to concentrate on. So I think we've had a quite remarkable success already. And obviously, we're going to keep up our reporting, our campaigning, and I expect us to draw attention in a very stark way to the contradiction between these, as I say, admirable foundations, Gates and Wellcome, who do so much good, but I think really shouldn't be having their money in things that have the potential to do unimaginable harm.
Looking again, say, at the analogy of ending slavery, the kind of political and social movement that had huge economic implications, in the United States, that wound up in a civil war, a really bloody war. In the UK, you folks divested of slaves in fits and starts, but there was not the kind of conflict. What's the difference there, and how might that lesson be applied today?
Well, I don't know whether this is so much Britain versus the US. This is probably the biggest imaginable global threat, and I think crosses all cultural, national, political boundaries, and it's only going to be solved by an international will. You've made the analogy with slavery. Other people are making the analogy with tobacco or with apartheid South Africa. I think those are the kind of sort of moral comparisons. But I think in the end, whether or not there is immediate political will, I think this thing will be determined by people who realize that those three figures that we talked about earlier have a kind of logic of their own, and nobody wants to be the person holding on to the pass the parcel at the moment when the bubble bursts. So I would anticipate that the more you can get this into the heads of the people who have their money there, and it's not like these assets have been performing particularly well over the last 10 years anyway, there will be a flight from fossil fuels. And once you get to that tipping point, then the whole economics of renewables versus fossil fuels changes, and I think things could begin to change quite quickly.
Alan Rusbridger is editor of The Guardian. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed that.